It is Friday, November the 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Islamic State Coalition and what action Russia's president might take.
You don't underestimate Putin and his ability to surprise you. And he's a guy who basically takes risks all the time.
Also ahead, Pope Francis in Africa and what Human Rights Watch is saying about it. Plus, what's trending on social media and making music at New York's Brill Building. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Good to have you with us today. French President François Hollande says he and Russian President Vladimir Putin have agreed to exchange intelligence on the Islamic State militants and other extremist groups in Syria to maximize the effectiveness of their bombing campaigns. President Putin said Russia is open to greater cooperation with France and the U.S. as well in picking the militant targets. Meantime, tensions between Russia and Turkey over the downing of a Russian warplane remain high. Moscow has announced plans to deploy an air defense missile system in northwestern Syria to protect its aircraft. Ambassador James Jeffrey, who was posted to Ankara and is now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it was a calculated move by President Putin.
It's probably the least Putin could do, and it represents not a good thing because it will threaten the Israelis, and the thing has a range of 155 miles, potentially also some of our aircraft if they were foolish enough to shoot at us. It's essentially a defensive step, and it's better than bombing a Turkish airfield.
Was that a possibility in your view?
Here's the thing. We have learned since 1999, with Putin's having a major role in Russian battalions showing up in Kosovo after we had defeated the Serbs, that you don't underestimate Putin and his ability to surprise you. And he's a guy who basically takes risks all the time with the assumption, which he has been proven correct again and again and again, with all of the NATO allies and all kinds of overflights of NATO territory, all sorts of provocations, his submarines in national waters, what he's done in Crimea, what he did in the Ukraine. And he's done this repeatedly with the Turks, particularly back in October. He not only penetrated Turkish airspace, but they locked on Turkish aircraft with their fire control radars. And they've been warned repeatedly by the Turks on this, and the Turks also warned them about bombing the Turkmen right along the border. I think he was surprised by what Erdogan did.
Is this going to suck the NATO alliance and Russia into some sort of confrontation?
I don't see how. If Russia takes military action against Turkey, yes, obviously, but Russia hasn't taken military action against Turkey. And NATO already has surface-to-air missiles in southern Turkey. We just withdrew them, but they can go back in. We have a relatively large contingent of aircraft at Incirlik and elsewhere in southern Turkey. And the Turks have a fleet of 200-plus F-16s. To put that in context, Putin has, well, he had 30 aircraft, roughly. Now he's got 29.
Senator Jeffrey says Russia has little leverage with Turkey, given its membership in NATO and control of key shipping lanes Russia uses. However, the University of San Francisco's Stephen Zunis was surprised at Turkey's military action.
This was a surprisingly provocative act by Turkey, given their economic dependence on Russia. I was actually on the Turkish coast just a few months ago, and I was struck by the large number of Russian tourists, including Russian business people. And so they will probably be feeling a hit as a result of this. I mean, when an airplane crosses international boundary into a country's airspace, they do have the legal right to shoot them down. But given that this infraction lasted only 17 seconds, and they were not bombing within Turkey, it does raise questions about why they would go to the extent of defending their airspace by actually shooting down a plane.
Neither side is backing down. Turkey's President Erdogan remained rather defiant that Turkey did the right thing.
There's a lot more at stake here than simply an infraction across a border. The bombing raids in that part of Syria near the Turkish border have not been directed at ISIS. ISIS does not have any presence in that province. They have been fighting fighters from al-Nusra, which Turkey has been quietly supporting. But they're also, and this is an important piece, Turkmen militia. These are an ethnic minority that are closely related to Turks themselves, who have been getting quite a bit of support from the Erdogan government Indeed, these were probably the targets of the Russian airstrikes, which is why Turkey may have felt a particular desire to take down that Russian plane.
Even as tensions with Turkey have increased, Russia continues to deal with its worsening relationship with Ukraine. Kiev announced this week its intention to switch to other natural gas suppliers and close its airspace to Russian airlines. Russian exporter Gazprom says it was halting deliveries over the amount of prepayments. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said the flight plan, the ban that is of flights, was essential because Russia might use its airspace to stage provocations and call it a matter of national security. Tensions between the two countries have escalated since Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine last year, and Moscow's ongoing support of separatist rebels in eastern Ukraine that has left more than 8,000 people dead. John Besmears of the Center for European Studies at the Australian National University tells Victor Beatty Russia has launched a trade war against Ukraine, and Kiev felt it had little to lose.
We need to remember, I think, that Mr. Putin's objective and that of the Russian elite is to bring Ukraine to its knees by one means or another. I think they hoped that the Minsk agreements would be a way of doing that, at least to the extent of establishing a secure protectorate in eastern Ukraine, as they have in other former communist bloc countries, and that this would force Ukraine into making concessions about the constitutionality of those protectorates. And this has not really worked for them, so I think the Russians have been upping the tempo a little. It's worth remembering that the Russians are even pursuing them over the $3 billion which was loaned to Mr. Yanukovych, and which the Ukrainian Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, I think, quite reasonably referred to as a bribe. We always need to remember that Ukraine is hanging on the edge of a precipice anyway in its economy as well as in its security, and that they were only able to get a bailout from the IMF on the basis that they would be able to gain some kind of closure on $15 billion of debt owed, of which $3 billion was debt owed to Russia, the $3 billion given to Yanukovych as a bribe. And Russia has recently been pursuing them uphill and down dale for that $3 billion. It seems bizarre to the common sense mind. I think that an aggressor should be able to pursue its victim for $3 billion of very, very dubious, sometimes described in technical terms as odious debt. So I think the Ukrainians don't have a great deal of choice, and I think also they're starting to flail a little bit in a rather ineffective way, perhaps, and that may be part of it. They're under pressure from all sides, and the government is losing its popularity domestically.
Well, there's a gas pipeline that runs to Europe through Ukraine from Russia. Is that going to cause problems for the rest of Europe?
In the short term, it might, but of course, Russia has plans for that. The plan is to increase the capacity of the Nord Stream lines that run to Germany, and that matter is still in the balance, but it is something that Russia is seeking to agree on with large German and other European gas interests. And the purpose of it is not economic, it's geopolitical, and it is to transfer the gas that is still going through Ukraine. Much of it already has been taken away from Ukraine and gone through, is going through Nord Stream 1. But if Nord Stream 2 is built in very short order, Ukraine would lose all its transit of gas, lose quite a lot of money, and it would give Russia potentially the capacity to strangle it of gas supplies. So the Ukrainians have, of course, been trying very hard to get out of that situation, and they have been receiving gas by reverse flow from Europeans. It's basically still Russian gas, but they're buying it from the Europeans. The Russians, however, are very unhappy with that, and they are trying to close off those options as well. So wherever you look, it is a bit of a minefield and a battlefield, and the Ukrainians, I think, are under tremendous pressure from many different sides, and they're uncertain about how much support, at the end of the day, they will get from the West. They got this reverse flow of gas, which was very good for them, but now the threat is that Nord Stream might take it, Nord Stream 2 might take it away from them again.
John Besmears of the Center for European Studies at Australian National University. He was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Boko Haram extremist group killed at least 15 in an attack Thursday on a village in Niger's southern border area of Diffa. United Nations has put at 50 the number of attacks and clashes between Islamist fighters and Niger troops since February, dozens of them in the Diffa region. About 150 schools and more than 12,000 pupils have been forced to close due to the attacks in Niger's southeast. The Global Terrorism Index, issued last week, said that Boko Haram has become the most deadly terrorist group in the world. Deaths attributed to the group in 2014 increased by 317% to 6,644. Islamic State, to which Boko Haram has pledged its allegiance, was responsible for 6,073 terrorist killings in the same year. Tens of thousands gathered in Nairobi to celebrate Mass with Pope Francis, the first Roman Catholic leader to visit Kenya since 1995. Earlier, Pope Francis told an audience of Christian and Muslim leaders that they must engage in dialogue to guard against the radicalization and acts of violence in the name of God. Later stops in Africa for the Pope will include Uganda and the Central African Republic. Human Rights Watch says Pope Francis's Africa tour provides a key moment for him to stand with the victim of rights abuses. Annika von Wurttemberg is spokesperson for Human Rights Watch. VOA's Kim Lewis spoke with her, asking her how the Pope might address human rights issues while he's in Africa.
Well, this, of course, is going to be hopefully a critical part of his mission, and the Central African Republic still in the middle of it. And so I think what the Pope will say about justice and accountability is going to be really important. And in the past, the Vatican has talked about the need for justice to build peaceful solutions to problems and how important justice is for peace. And we very much hope the Pope will reiterate that message.
Do you think the leaders of the countries will also put into place measures that will help alleviate some of the suffering of the people who are experiencing these abuses?
Certainly, there have been steps taken in the Central African Republic to put in place some mechanisms to try to bring justice. Those are in the very early stages, and to date, we haven't seen anyone being held to account for it yet. In Kenya and Uganda, the government has largely ignored questions of justice for these significant abuses that have taken place. You know, it's of course not the only question of human rights abuses that the Pope will be facing in all the countries. You know, in two of the countries, Uganda and the Central African Republic, they're about to head into elections. And especially in Uganda, we've seen crackdowns already on free speech, on peaceful assembly, on the possibility for the opposition to organize. You know, a problem that is in fact hitting us across Africa.
Another expectation is the Pope speaking on religious tolerance and also tolerance for those of sexual and gender minorities.
The sexual and gender minorities is, of course, an issue across Africa. We have seen continued widespread violence against individuals of sexual and gender minorities. Certainly at Human Rights Watch, we don't expect that the Vatican is going to see eye to eye with us on everything in relation to the rights of the LGBT community. But this is a moment for the Pope to reiterate a message he has said in a number of other environments of stopping violence against people of sexual and gender minorities, and indeed condemning that violence, it will be important for the Pope to really reiterate the stance that he has said on occasion of not condoning this violence, of very much condemning it and showing tolerance for people of sexual and gender minorities. The same would go, we would say at Human Rights Watch, for those of ethnic minorities, particularly in Kenya, where individuals of Somali origin have been targeted in recent waves of violence, and of course in the Central African Republic, of people of the Muslim religion. And that should be really the strong message of tolerance and to stop discrimination.
Annika von Vonberg is a spokesperson for Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of VOA's program Africa News Tonight. Burkina Faso votes for a new president and parliament on Sunday, just over a year after mass protests there ousted longtime leader Blaise Compaoré. It has been a tumultuous transition at times. Elections had to be postponed last month after a foiled coup. And as Emily Yeob reports, voters are saying it is time for a fresh start.
Longtime opposition figure Zéphirin Diabré held a rally in the Burkina Faso's capital just days before the vote.
You want to move forward or to go backward? You want a true change or a fake change?
Diabré's main challenger in the presidential race is another economist, Roch-Marc Christian Caboré. Caboré was a longtime ally and cabinet member of ex-president Blaise Compaoré. But he left Compaoré's side last year when the president tried to change the constitution to extend his already 27-year rule. Massive protests ousted Compaoré and he fled the country. For some, Caboré can't be trusted. For others, his decaying government are a selling point.
To me, he's the most experienced candidate. He has shown us what he can do. He's a unifier, a man of the people, an upright man.
12 other candidates, including two women, are running. Another frontrunner among them is Benewende Sankara, who claims to be the political heir of former president and national icon Thomas Sankara, killed during the coup that brought Compaoré to power. The former ruling party, the CDP, does not have a presidential candidate on the ballot. Transitional authorities barred anyone who supported Compaoré's effort to change the constitution from running.
On conteste pas.
We hope to win a good amount of parliamentary seats and come back into the race for power.
Political debates are popping up on TV and across town as voting day approaches. For many, here at the University of Ouagadougou, it will be their first time voting.
We have a historic opportunity during which the popular masses will tame the politicians and make them respect the people's will.
They want the momentum for change to continue.
We have been waiting for this for so long that it's thrilling as voting day gets closer. This is a risky election. We are impatient, but we pray everything will go well.
Analysts say a second-round presidential runoff is likely. Emily Yeob for VOA News in Ouagadougou.
And now it's time to see what's trending online. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here with the latest. Hey, G, so what's happening?
Hi, Steve. It was Thanksgiving on Thursday, so let's begin with what many people consider to be the most important element of this holiday, the food. Millions of Americans gather to enjoy turkey, stuffing, and all kinds of spreads, but two Americans had a slightly different fare. They're NASA astronauts Terry Virts and Barry Wilmore, almost 300 miles above the Earth.
You know, it's pretty difficult to stuff a turkey with zero gravity, so what did these guys have?
The answer, Steve, is in the YouTube video NASA posted. The two American astronauts, with the help of their four colleagues on the International Space Station, put together some of the core items they already have. So that came out to be turkey exposed to radiation, candied yams, and freeze-dried cornbread dressing. To top it off, the dessert was made with cranberry and apple. So from the video, it looks like they also have sriracha on hand.
Well, that's good. So they can spice up things if they wanted to. Tell us about the sauce, though, because I'm sure many of our listeners are not familiar at all with it.
Sure. It's a pretty popular condiment here in America, originating from Thailand. It's made in California, created by a Vietnamese-American named David Tran. It's spicy and a bit more watery than ketchup. Other companies came up with their own versions of this sauce, and the word sriracha is now considered a generic term by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
I understand, G. So before you go, tell us one other story that's trending today.
Sure, the next story is not very much in line with the Thanksgiving spirit, but it is making headlines. Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump was mocking a New York Times reporter at a rally in South Carolina, and the reporter apparently has a joint condition that affects his arm movement. Trump was imitating the reporter, moving his arms every which way, and what's quite disturbing is that the people at the rally are seen laughing at his comical gestures, mocking at a physically challenged person. Now, we have been talking a lot about the billionaire contender in recent months, but maybe after this incident, we might hear less about him, at least in the context of the presidential race. Back to you, Steve.
And many thanks, UG. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. If you'd like to, you can find G on Twitter. Her handle is at G. Abby Lee. You can also follow International Edition on Twitter. We're at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? Walking for money, literally. It's a new app called Bitwalking. It installs on your smartphone, and with it, you make money. Just by walking. Using GPS and complicated algorithms, the Bitwalking app converts kilometers into money. You get one virtual dollar for every 8 kilometers walked. This virtual money goes into your Bitwalking account to use for purchases from the app's online marketplace. Japanese investors are the major financial force behind Bitwalking so far, paying most of the $10 million in startup costs. To start, Bitwalking will only be available in 4 places: Japan, Kenya, Malawi, and the United Kingdom. In less developed countries like Malawi, workers in rural areas earn around $45 a month. By tracking their steps, Bitwalking developers say some of these workers could nearly double their income. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from our music department.
I hear the neon lights are bright on Broadway. I hear the dreams come true there every day.
The Brill Building is on Broadway. It's been home to dozens of music companies where songwriters such as Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil wrote hits like On Broadway for the R&B girls group The Cookies. The song was later covered by greats such as George Benson, for whom it was a chart topper. And then there was this super hit. Little Eva singing The Locomotion, written by the husband and wife team of Jerry Goffin and Carol King. They wrote the song in their offices at the Brill Building. Locomotion was not only a big hit for Little Eva, Grand Funk Railroad and Kylie Minogue also went to the top of the charts with the song in the 1970s and 80s. And guess who this is?
I thought love was only true in fairy tales, and for someone else, but not for me. Our love was out to get me, and that's the way it seemed. Disappointment haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer.
That's The Monkees singing Neil Diamond's I'm a Believer, written at the Brill Building early on in Diamond's career.
I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried.
Remember this song? A singles hit and an Academy Award winner for the film Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Raindrops are falling on my head.
just like a guy whose feet are too big for his bed. Nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head. They keep falling. So I just did me some talking to the sun.
Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head was written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David at the Brill Building and sung by B.J. Thomas.
Those raindrops are falling on my head, they keep falling. But there's one thing I know, the blues they send to meet me.
The so-called Brill Building sound includes the mainstream of American popular songs from gospel to rhythm and blues, pop, country, and rock and roll. The Brill Building still stands in the heart of New York's theater district where it was built in 1931.
But that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. Crying's not for me, 'cause I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining, because I'm free. Nothing's worrying me.
Hey, it seems like only yesterday for B.J. Thomas, not 50 years ago. Can you imagine? Well, currently, Adele's making all the news. She's going to do a tour, her first since 2011, with a string of European dates, all to introduce her new album, 25. Doesn't need a lot of introduction. It's doing pretty well already. Turned out that it sold 2.4 million copies just in the few days after it was released. Can you imagine? Good for Adele. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. Latest world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hard on the heels of the terrorist attack in Paris, which resulted in the deaths of some 130 people, came a terrorist attack on a hotel in Bamako, the capital of Mali. Prior to 2012, Mali was one of Africa's longest established democracies, but a failure to deal with ethnic tensions in the north, as well as the presence of extremist groups operating from safe havens in the north, led to a Tuareg rebellion. This rebellion was then usurped by violent extremist elements, reinforced with arms and fighters from Libya. The country was destabilized, and this led to a military coup in 2012. Extremists with links to Al-Qaeda occupied large parts of northern Mali and began to institute their fundamentalist version of Sharia and brutalize the civilian population, forcing thousands to flee. The Malian government requested help. In 2012, a French military force backed by African partners from Chad and Niger under Operation Sabre disrupted and scattered extremist forces, which largely fled to Tunisia and Libya. However, remnants of the extremist group continue asymmetric attacks against the Malian government as well as the United Nations peacekeeping mission. The French continue counterterrorism operations against extremists. There is good reason to believe that terrorists chose their target specifically because the hotel is popular with foreigners, and at the time of the attack was hosting a number of delegations attending peace talks. At least 22 people died, among them 6 Russians, 3 Chinese nationals, an Israeli, an American, 2 Belgians, 1 citizen of Senegal, and another from Lebanon. Many of the victims, including one American, were people who came to Bamako to help the Malian government and the Malian people through difficult times. These international efforts to restore peace, security, and prosperity in Mali will continue. The support of the U.S. government in these efforts will continue as well. The United States condemns in the strongest terms the terrorist attacks in Bamako. We extend our deep condolences to the families and loved ones of those who have been killed in this heinous attack, said U.S. National Security Council spokesman Ned Price. The United States stands with the people of Mali and will remain a steadfast partner along with other key allies and African partners fighting the terrorist groups that seek to undermine Mali's efforts to build durable peace and stability.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.